Support for WGTD's morning show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we hear from one of the country's leading authorities on finding a job. In part two of today's program, we hear from two members of the descendants of Emily Post on how to teach your children manners. Stay with us. I am very excited to be reconnecting on this portion of the morning show with Martin Yate, with whom I've had the pleasure of speaking on several occasions. He is one of the country's foremost authorities and experts when it comes to the job search and career management, and is especially well known for his job search manual called Knock 'Em Dead, and that has just been released in a special 30th anniversary edition. And literally millions of people have turned to this job search manual for assistance over the years, with all kinds of terrific suggestions and also plenty of discussion of a more philosophical nature, which really helps people approach the daunting task of looking for a job, trying to secure a wonderful new job, trying to go about that task with a renewed sense of confidence and peace of mind. The book is published by Adams Media. Again, we're talking about the 30th anniversary edition, the 2015 edition of Knock 'Em Dead, the ultimate job search guide. Martin Yate, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Greg, good to be with you. I usually hate flattery, except when it's headed in my direction. Thank you so much for the introduction.
Glad to be talking with you today. Could you just say a word about, because, of course, many of the fundamentals do not change very much at all in terms of what it feels like to be out of work, how important it is to find a job, and certain basic bedrock principles of how to get that next job. But obviously enough things change that you feel it necessary and appropriate to take the time to constantly revise your job search guide. What are the kinds of things that change that prompt the perpetual revision of your job guide? What are the changes that matter the most?
Well, actually, when 2 minutes before the show started, I was working on the 31st edition of this book. and you'd think after 30 I'd have got it right. But the case is this. We live at the dawn of a new era. We're living at the dawn of the digital age. And the digital age has changed the way everyone does every job. And because of that, it's changed the way companies look for employees, and that changes the way we have to look for jobs as individuals. So I live in a world that is constantly changing. I was talking to someone yesterday who'd been told that he should follow his bliss, and I immediately thought of a man in rags with a tin cup and a sign around his neck saying, "I followed my bliss," and standing on a street corner. You know, we need to be pragmatic about our lives. We're going to be working for 50 years, changing jobs about every 4 years, have three or more distinctly different careers. And that says we should base our core career, a central career, on something pragmatic, like the size and health of the industry, and an industry that isn't going to go away because of technological change or demographics. Things like healthcare, aging society, job you can take anywhere, a profession where age discrimination really isn't very prevalent, versus blogger, one of the highest growth jobs in the world. But I think there's still only 30 people that actually make a living doing it, Greg.
Hmm.
So I'm not saying don't pursue your dreams. I'm saying build them on a firm foundation. It's not an either-or world. Pursue a core or central career in a healthy industry and build your skills in that area. Be loyal and work hard. And you can then apply those same skills to the pursuit of your dreams and the pursuit of your entrepreneurial endeavors.
One of the most interesting parts of your book, and I mean, I'm blessed to be in a situation where I'm not looking for a job. As far as I know, I won't be looking for a job in the near future, but of course, one never knows. But even as somebody, in a sense, who doesn't need a job guide, I really enjoyed and found really interesting the second chapter of the book, in which you explore this notion of transferable skills and professional values, and help somebody who's looking for a job to kind of think about their own transferable skills and professional values, how they can potentially be of value to a potential employer. But it occurred to me that it's probably a healthy thing for just about all of us to do. It's another way to kind of look at ourselves, at our strengths, at our weaknesses, and sort of sort out some of the ways in which maybe we most matter professionally. Tell our listeners about what you're talking about with transferable skills and professional values and why it's important to think about those things when one is embarking on a job search.
You raise a very interesting point, and I was at a major international conference, human resources conference, a couple of months ago when someone was standing up on stage, and they were talking about recruitment and talking about job description and saying, you know, every job description in the world has words like communication skills, multitasking, teamwork, and problem solving, and they don't mean anything. And he ranted on like this, and it's just absurd. These are the most common words in the job descriptions we see posted online. And the reason they're the most common is because they're important. It's not that your job is necessarily to multitask or to make good decisions or, you know, have good analytical skills. It's that these are the skills that underlie whatever you do. I'm a writer. You know, time management and organization is right up there with me to do everything I have to do in a week, and it's the same for you. And there's someone driving down Interstate I-95 now in an 18-wheeler, and it's the same for him or her. You know, there are certain professional skills that underlie success in whatever we do. And if we understand what these professional transferable skills and values are and build them into our resume and understand how we apply them in our jobs, we can then introduce them into the conversations we have at job interviews. And this is not only one of the important foundations of Knock 'Em Dead. It's one of the ways you differentiate yourself as a candidate at a job. It helps you win job offers. And if you apply these transferable skills and values once you're at work, you're going to make your job more secure. You're going to be attractive to the inner circle that exists in every department and every company. You know, everyone has an inner circle and an outer circle. And where you stand depends on where you want to stand. It's a simple choice. And it will make your job more secure because you will be welcomed into the inner circle because you exhibit these values and skills. You'll get plum assignments, better opportunities, raises, promotions, and you'll also be more valuable to the company, which makes your job more secure, and you will be more marketable should anything happen or the time come for you to initiate a move on your own decision.
It's a really helpful portion of the book, and I should think that just about anybody, once they've read that chapter, will probably come away maybe thinking better about themselves, because, you know, you really help us start thinking about maybe facets of our personality that maybe we don't take the time to really appreciate. I mean, things like determination. You know, maybe you are a person who has great determination but haven't really ever stopped to really think about the way in which that matters and might really matter to an employer. Or if you really are a creative person, although maybe you're creative in ways that aren't you know, particularly obvious. I mean, you're not creative in the sense that you love to paint pictures or write poems or something, but in other ways in your life are creative. I mean, I really appreciate the way in which this part of your book helps each of us, in a sense, come to appreciate our own gifts, whatever they are.
Yeah. Can I pick up on that word creative? Because creativity is one of the six transferable skills that I talked about. And creativity is one of the most complex ones. It requires that, number one, you have exceptional technical skills and that you have good time management and organization and can multitask and have good communication skills. It requires that you are very, very good at your job. And creativity in our professional lives comes to people who have made the effort to become superior in their work and to communicate well and multitask and manage their time and use good analytical skills and problem-solving skills. And they become creative because they're good in all these other areas and they have a wider frame of reference. That's what creativity is in the professional world. They bring new solutions to old problems because they have developed themselves along the right lines.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Martin Yate, talking about the 30th anniversary edition of his bestseller, Knock 'Em Dead, Ultimate Job Search Guide. You've already touched on the fact that it really helps if we, you know, choose wisely in terms of our target job. I mean, what we go after, think about our own skills, what the market looks like. Once someone has some kind of target sort of in one's sights, then you start taking the reader through some of the tangible steps of the process, including how to build, in your words, a killer resume. What would you say are the most significant mistakes that people tend to make when they put together their resumes?
Let's start with the very easy ones. You know, not only have I been writing about this for many years, we have a resume writing and coaching business. And we deal with people from the highest levels of the world's biggest technology corporations down to the kids of these people who I helped 20 years ago, who are now coming out of college. And the biggest mistake you see is that people think that a resume is a recitation of everything they've done in life. Now Greg, I'd like you and everyone listening this morning to think about the first lesson we all learned in our professional lives. If you can recall sometime in the first few days at work, and I know this is how it happened to me, and it may have happened to you in a similar way, my boss came up to me and playfully clapped me up the side of the head and said, Martin, don't you get it? It's about what the customer wants. The customer's always right. And I went, oh, kind of makes sense. And then he gave me another playful tap up the side of the head and said, all you have to do is find out what the customer wants and give it to them. Okay, now let's apply that to resumes. Most of our resumes say name, Martin Yate, telephone number, email address, and then it says objective. No one cares what you want. No one cares what you want. And here's the other thing. There's no one listening today that's ever read a book, read a blog, read a newspaper, read a magazine, watched a TV show, watched a movie that didn't have a title. Title draws you in. So instead of starting a resume with what you want, which no one cares about till they put an offer on the table, you start with something that helps get your resume found in the resume databases and gives the reader an immediate focus. You put a target job title. And following that, the steps we take people through is we go through something called target job deconstruction, which is find out what the customer wants, how they think about this job, how they prioritize it, and the words they use. And once we know what the customer wants, then you can go back into your work history and pull out the examples of your work that tell that story. It isn't a matter of creating a resume that says everything about you, and it isn't a matter of creating a resume that says you can do all things for all people. You know, that's a Swiss Army knife, but no one's hiring Swiss Army knives anymore. You know, it has to be focused on a single job, and this is the biggest mistake people make at the very beginning of their job search.
Right. In addition to that, one really interesting part of the book is all about the notion of networking. And I think it's really interesting that this chapter of your book is as lengthy as it is and thorough, because it speaks not only to how important networking is in terms of hearing about opportunities and getting that proverbial foot in the door, but also the fact that networking is so dramatically different from the way it was certainly 10 years ago, or Lord, 20 years ago, or 30 years ago when you first wrote a job guide. And although in some ways it's easier, in some ways it's also harder because it's such a jungle out there. Obviously you're trying to give advice to help people navigate through all the options available in terms of networking.
Yeah, and you know, you say this is a long chapter on networking. We've actually spun off a whole book called Knockin' Dead Social Networking. So that long chapter is actually pretty short.
In this grand scheme of things, right?
Yeah, in the grand scheme. Look, we mentioned earlier, you're going to be working for 50 years. You're going to have somewhere between 12 and 15 job changes probably. Right? The single most important professional skill you can ever develop is your ability to get job interviews and then turn those job interviews into job offers. That kind of makes sense, doesn't it? And most of us know 20 or 30 people that we've known at different jobs and become friends with. And those are the networks we have. And, you know, in our resume and coaching business, we do business with executives from all over the world. They all have the same problem. They've got a network of maybe 40 people at the outside, and they haven't built social networks. In a world where there is no longer any job security, people and your connection to your profession is going to help you through this new era of job insecurity. Much better than being blindly loyal to your employer and working for them 14, 15 hours a day and then going home and going to sleep. So we have to invest ourselves in becoming connected to our professional community. And the online world of social networking, especially sites like LinkedIn, are tremendously important. LinkedIn has, it's probably more, I mean, it's changing every moment, 270-odd million members. Half of them are in America. That's a good chunk of our professional working population. And they have lots of groups there. So there's lots of groups for writers. There's lots of groups for people in media. There's lots of groups for engineers and physical therapists and everyone else. And this is a way you essentially, on this social media site, your profile is your professional resume. And you join the groups that are relevant to you, and you want to join groups that are people with your same job title, and the job title's 1, 2, and 3 levels above you. And the reason we do this is these people 1, 2, and 3 levels above you are the men and women who are going to hire you for all these jobs over the next 50 years. And they're probably going to stay just a little bit ahead of you as you grow. So you're building a network of professionally relevant people.
You have a whole chapter devoted to making contact, which we'll leave to our listeners to read for themselves. But you really give some interesting information on how to make that initial contact and how to most effectively make that contact. And you also go extensively into the whole matter of interviews. And one thing I thought was interesting is that you differentiate between the telephone interview and the interview which is in person. Why do you think that distinction is so important? I mean, why is it worth talking about them in two different ways, in a sense?
Well, any interview you have with a headhunter is going to be over the telephone. The vast majority of initial human resources interviews are going to be over the telephone. And increasingly, the hiring managers see a telephone interview as a time-saving tool. I walk into your office, Greg, and you can tell from the way I look and smell, you wouldn't hire me if I was the last person on earth. You still got to let me sit down and say hello. You still got to bumble around for 5 or 10 minutes before you can politely kick me out, which takes another 5 minutes, and there's gone 15 or 20 minutes of your day. If you do it on the telephone, you're talking business within 60 seconds. You know, hi, Martin, how are you? Pleasure to speak to you. I have your resume in front of me, and I see you're interested in such and such a job. I'd like to ask you a few questions. And in a telephone interview, you're going to face knockout questions. And this relates back to what we're talking about resumes. Find out what the employer wants and what they prioritize. Find out what's important. So in the telephone interview, they're going to want to find out if you've got the skills they need to ensure that if you are invited in for an in-person interview, it's not going to be a waste of time.
You have a whole chapter on how to dress for the interview, another chapter on body language, and I especially found fascinating the whole chapter in which you list a number of great answers to interview questions, some of which can really be tough. I think particularly because in many cases, these open-ended questions leave you with too many options, and you have to choose the right way to answer one of those questions when it's, tell us about a time when you had to such and such, or what do you think about such and such? I really appreciate this. Have the questions that are asked in job interviews changed a lot over the years?
No, the more they change, the more they stay the same. Yet there are always new ways of phrasing questions, but the concerns are still essentially the same. Because if we reduce any job, your job, my job, the job of everyone listening there, we all have that job for one reason. Because they couldn't export it to Mumbai, India, give it to someone younger and cheaper, or automate it out of existence. Which means it exists because there are problems to solve, problems to identify, prevent, and solve, in fact. So you can anticipate a lot of questions that if they're talking to you, for example, about accounts receivable, say you're an accounts receivable person, anyone can collect the money that's sent in without problems. What we should be thinking about, and what you're probably going to be facing questions about, is what do you do with the people who go over 30-day payables and who go over 45-day payables? And you can anticipate this in advance if you begin to think about your job of what problems am I there to solve? What are my areas of responsibility? What are the problems that occur in those areas? And what can I do to prevent them from occurring in the first place and to solve them? Mm. And I'd like to add one other thing here, if I may, Greg. You know, before you're going into the interview, you're terrified, you're wondering if they're going to like you and all this stuff. And what none of us realize, and I do because I've been a headhunter and because I've been head of HR at a public company and head of training and development at a division of another public company, is on the other side of the door, that interviewer, just before you go in, slip down to his or her knees, they clasp their hands, they're looking up to the sky, and they're saying, please let this be the one I can hire. I just want someone who can do the job and play well with others, and then I can hire them and get back to my job. When you go for an interview, they want to hire you. And if you go in and saying, I'll cross my fingers and hope I can answer the questions, you may or you may not get the job. But if you read this second section, and you know, Knock 'Em Dead 2015, the 30th edition, is 385 pages. The second half of it is all about the interview questions, what's behind them, what they're looking for, what you should build your answer on, and some example answers. And if you go prepared, you make it so much easier for them to say, this is the one I can hire and go back and do my own job.
Hmm. It's a wonderfully put together book, which ends with some interesting appendices, including 30 fast-growing occupations, which give the listener who maybe is wondering what sector to be looking at some great ideas about the most promising arenas for the job search. It's a beautifully put together book, and I can well imagine anybody who finds themselves in this situation would derive all sorts of great assistance from it. The Knock 'Em Dead Ultimate Job Search Guide 2015, the 30th Anniversary Edition. published by Adams Media, and the author, Martin Yate. Martin Yate, I'm so grateful to you for joining me today on The Morning Show, and I know your book and even our conversation is going to make a difference for the better for somebody out there who is in need of a job. And I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Your lips to God's ears, and thank you indeed for having me on the show, Greg. Have a wonderful day, everybody.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. The time is 8:36. Part two is next. We're going to be talking about manners today on the Morning Show, and specifically how parents can go about instilling a higher standard of manners with their children. And we go to the well-respected name of Post for this discussion, specifically to Cindy Post Senning, who is co-director of the Emily Post Institute. And she is the co-author, along with Peggy Post, of a book called Emily Post's The Gift of Good Manners, A Parent's Guide to Raising Respectful, Kind, Considerate Children, published by Harper Resource. And this is a wonderful book which gives us all kinds of things to think about in terms of the importance of manners and the means by which we might teach the very best in manners to our children. And I'm really glad that I can speak with Cindy Post Senning for the next few minutes about this book and the experience of writing it. Cindy Post Senning, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Before we get to the book itself, I think it would really be fun for our listeners and for me to have a little better sense of the Post name and more specifically the name of Emily Post, of who she was and what she ended up managing to create.
Well, sure. I love talking about Emily. Emily was my great-grandmother, and back in 1922, she had been writing romance novels and had some association with people in the publishing world who felt at that time that there was a great need for a practical, usable book on etiquette. People were moving into the cities. It was the industrial age was coming, and people were moving away from their rural agrarian homes where they all knew what to do. In your village at home, if somebody was getting married, everybody knew what the routine was and what the standard was. But if you had just moved to Chicago or New York or Los Angeles and you were invited to dinner somewhere or to a wedding, you didn't know. And so people had a great need for defining the standard and what the standard was. And Emily was an extremely gracious woman who had grown up in New York City and did know, was familiar with the standards, and also had an innate sense of the way we build relationships, and she even articulated this, was by treating each other with respect and consideration, and that manners were tools that we could use to articulate those fundamental principles in our relationships. So she, after being literally harassed by her publishers, said, oh, okay, I'll write the book. It'll be short, and that'll be it. And she wrote this 600-page book that was published in 1922 and was an instant success, immediately went to the top of the bestseller list, and that framed the rest of her life. She was 50 years old at that time and lived till 1960, and all of her work was dedicated to promoting etiquette in this country at that time.
Wonderful. You have collaborated with Peggy Post, and I can't remember what the connection is between the two of you.
Right. Peggy is my sister-in-law. I have three brothers, and Peggy's married to one of my brothers and has been working at the Emily Post Institute, the organization my great-grandmother founded, as our spokesperson, and has rewritten the large etiquette book several times. Peggy got so many questions and concerns from people out there about writing a book to guide parents that she had decided to do that. In the meantime, my background was in both health and education. I've done a lot of work in both those fields with parents and children, and maternal child health, and we decided to collaborate and bring our two bases together and work on this book.
Very good. One last question ahead of the book. Tell us what the Emily Post Institute is. You are its co-director.
Yes, it's an organization that my grandmother started in order to continue her work in promoting etiquette in the United States today, trying to get the message out there that the way we build and strengthen our relationships is through the use of etiquette, a combination of manners and those three principles of respect and consideration and honesty.
Very good. We're speaking with Cindy Post Senning, co-author of a book which we will now start talking about,
sure.
Emily Post's The Gift of Good Manners, A Parent's Guide to Raising Respectful, Kind, Considerate Children. You know, it's interesting as I was thinking about this. A lot of times when we think about etiquette and manners among adults, we sort of jump to the erroneous conclusion that it's mostly about which fork to use and that kind of thing. And when, of course, at its heart, it's about things that matter a whole lot more than that. It's really about the way we treat each other.
Right.
Somehow, when I think about teaching manners and etiquette to children, I don't find myself jumping to that erroneous conclusion. Somehow, you just naturally have this sense that that's what manners mean in terms of young people, is how we treat each other. And yet, it's not an easy match, not an easy thing to accomplish in this day and age.
Right. Well, and what we try and do is we see, and it's not easy anyway, because people are dealing with kids at different ages, which is why we've approached this book developmentally. What are the things you can do as your kids move through different developmental stages in their lives? And we have two threads of advice for teaching this. So even as manners change and we get new, you know, I think of manners as the tools or the social skills that we can use in building relationships. But as kids move through their developmental stages, what are the things that we can do? And I suggest two things to parents. First off, I suggest that they know what to expect. So know your children and gain some understanding about what they can do at the different developmental stages in their life. And then expect it. So that's key one. Know what to expect and then expect it. And the second thing is what we call the golden rule of parenting. Always behave the way you want your children to behave. That's really where kids will learn. Because through your behavior, you establish a climate or a culture in your own household that is one of those three, based on those three principles.
Something, too, which I think is great is that this book does not limit itself to teaching your children good manners, but you also have lots of thoughts along the way about parents being themselves very polite. Not just for the sake of modeling for their children, but just because they should be and need to be polite in their interactions with, for instance, other parents, with teachers, with doctors, and that kind of thing. What a wonderful idea, because the one is certain to help the other.
Right, and that is how kids learn that. If parents treat teachers with respect and consideration, kids learn that teachers are people to be treated with respect and consideration. If parents try and teach kids a message at home of treating other people respectfully or with consideration, and then go in and are disrespectful, you know, in a setting that's very important to the kids, they get a very mixed message that it becomes hard for them to sort through, and then their behavior changes accordingly. And parents will get mad at them for not being respectful of their teachers and forget how they were, you know, a week ago when they went in angry because the teacher had done something.
I was intrigued at one point in the book when you called etiquette and manners two things, and they both begin with the letter G. You called etiquette as a gift that
right.
we can give to someone, and you also called it glue. And, you know, the one term is a whole lot prettier than the other.
Right.
But in both of these respects, it gives us a different sense of why it's worth talking about this and
right.
writing books about this.
Right. I love that. I never thought of them as the two G's. I'll keep that in mind. But yes, well, certainly it's a gift. We talk about it. It's a gift that's free and available to everybody to give to their children. And with manners, kids develop confidence, and it improves their self-esteem because they do better in some of their relationships and some of their interactions, so they get a better self-esteem. And they'll enjoy situations more. If we think about ourselves, if we go to a wedding in a strange culture, if somebody's told us what to expect ahead of time, we'll enjoy the wedding more because we won't worry about doing something wrong. So what we consider that just a tremendous gift if you think about it, giving your kids confidence, you know, self-esteem, and the ability to enjoy things more and get more out of the various things they're going to do in their lives. Those are terrific gifts. We call it the glue because it really is how we hold relationships together. When we stop treating each other, using manners in the way we treat and work with each other, and stop being respectful, relationships fall apart. People begin to focus on the bad behavior or the behavior that's been hurtful in some way, and they don't focus on what the relationship's about. So in something as simple as if you've paid to have a lesson of some kind and the person who you've paid to have that lesson comes 15 minutes late, you get so worried about not getting your full hour, you know, that lateness really affects the relationship.
Well, and it hurts what manages to be accomplished because it creates this distraction in the middle of it all.
Exactly. So then the focus shifts to the behavior that's creating the problem, and the whole thing falls apart. So, but if had you been on time, which would be the good manners, then the relationship hangs in there together. So it works out. It's the glue. When it's missing, relationships fall apart, and when it's there, it helps hold relationships together.
At some point in the book, I can't find it right now, you list a number of the benefits of living the mannerly life, if we want to call it that, and I'm pretty sure that right at the top of that list was self-confidence.
Yes.
That one, and that goes for children as well as adults, that one can move through life with a greater sense of self-confidence. And that's, of course, huge when it comes to whatever it is that we want to accomplish, or especially when life throws some challenges at us.
Exactly, exactly. And if we know that the way we're presenting ourselves and putting ourselves out there and involving ourselves in relationships is a way that's going to strengthen and build that relationship, we're just going to be more confident in whatever the activity is that we're engaging in.
It's interesting how at certain points in the book, you will break down the larger scheme of manners and etiquette into certain things that we wouldn't necessarily think of. I mean, we obviously know that this has something to do with table manners and something to do with writing thank you notes and that kind of thing.
Right.
But that it also includes something like our values and our ethics. Explain to us a little more about that connection, because I think that's a little less obvious to us.
Well, if we think about it in terms of our ethics, let's think about it in terms of honesty, that third principle, and the way we approach things with honesty, rather, and try and think about the way that can play into our interaction. So when I'm talking with children, say a 10-year-old, you know, and I'm talking with them about going to their grandmother's for dinner, and they don't care for the spinach, you know. they just don't like it, and so they're putting it aside on the plate. And the grandmother has worked all afternoon making this delicious dinner for them and says, "What's the matter? Don't you like the spinach, you know?" Well, you can go with the white lie and say, "Oh, well, I'm full, Grandma," or whatever, you know. Or you can instead, and we teach kids to say this, how can you be honest and turn it into a positive experience. You can say, "You know, Grandma, I've never really cared for spinach a whole lot, but this chicken is so delicious. Thank you for making it." Well, now they've been honest about the spinach, but they've established, you know, the grandmother's now thinking, "Oh, good, she loves the chicken." It immediately deflects the negativism. So there are ways that we can be honest about things, and we encourage people not to go with the white lie thinking that that's the nicer thing to do. It almost always gets you into more hot water. And we talk about working with your kids on what we call benevolent honesty and how you can do that. How do you bypass that question about, you know, how does this taste or how does this look, by framing it in a positive sense. Now, that's something that I think in the way we approach this in the book, as we say, as a family, you have to make some decisions about these things. So as parents, if that's what you're going to commit to, if honesty and being able to build trust in relationships, which naturally we're encouraging people to do, is important to you as a family, then you have to make a commitment to it. And as a parent, you have to agree that you're not going to go to that calling in sick on that beautiful day because you really wanted to go skiing or whatever it is, you know, or not modeling kind of those little dishonesties that may not get you in huge trouble but change a, set a different tone in your family. Mm.
You know, I better understand now something very early in the book. I was talking about it before, all the benefits of living in more in a mannerly sort of way, that self-confidence is one of them. But I found the list, and as I looked down it, I start to realize in just what you were explaining now how living this way would develop these kind of things, that we develop more of a consideration for others, more respect for others.
Right.
We develop more common sense. I mean, that's a big part of what you were just describing.
Right.
Tact, of course, and also flexibility.
Yes.
The fact that life throws us things, and it is not an ironclad set of rules that help us live this life, but something that can move and bend according to the circumstances in which we find ourselves.
That's correct. And if you base them, what we make ironclad is that we're going to live by those three principles. The manners are a little bit more flexible. We can change. We refer to them as guidelines now. We no longer think of them as rules. They are standards, and they do change. The difference between manners and the principles are that the manners do change. The original book has that whole chapter on chaperones. It's not there anymore. There was nothing in the original book about cell phones. There's a whole chapter about cell phones now, you know. So the manners change. They change both over time and from culture to culture. That's what we talk about so often in the book, about parents making some kinds of decisions between themselves so there's consistency in the household about what the culture of that household's going to be. It'll be different. You know, we walk into lots of different houses that do things differently. But the underlying principles of respect and consideration and honesty, in Peggy's, in my opinion, are they're like rules. You know, those don't change. And when my great-grandmother wrote the book in 1922, they were the basis for all the manners, and they are still the basis for all the manners.
Right. You were talking about how this book works chronologically as children develop through various phases, and it's interesting. You call part of it the age of discovery, and another is the socialization years. Another are the bumpy years. Surprise,
right.
Surprise! They're the early teenage years, and so on. I think at the start of each section, you have a little line which says, "Now's the time to."
Yeah.
And then there's a little list there from that list springs the chapter that follows then. But
right.
Those things which it makes sense to address. And I suppose it really makes sense according to where a child is in his or her development that you tackle the right things, the things that they are capable of truly addressing.
Exactly. That's sort of the know what to expect and then expect it kind of thing. These are the things you can be doing with your child developmentally. You can expect these things from these kids. So I'm just looking at the socialization years, and I have stressed good sportsmanship, 6 through 10 years old. They're just getting into team sports. They're beginning to play with that. This is an important time for them to begin to understand the fundamentals of sportsmanship.
Hmm. Well, I was looking like age of discovery, which is ages 3 through 5, teach and encourage sharing, that is when you need to
right.
really be thinking about that. And I suppose if you don't do that, then we have the possibility of someone walking into school
right.
Incapable of really functioning.
Right. And also you don't want to, and the thing I see almost more frequently than people not doing it is I see people trying to get a two-year-old to share. Well, two-year-olds developmentally aren't ready to do that. They're going to do parallel play. They'll play next to each other. But it's very difficult for them to do real sharing in the way we do it. Maybe we can begin to set some time limits and have them give the toy over. But they may very well not be able to let go of that toy very well because developmentally they don't have the skill. But by 3, they ought to begin to be able to do that. You would want them to be doing that.
Hmm.
And you should be working with that.
Very good. Well, this book is absolutely terrific, and I'm not even a parent, but I just digested it with great, great interest, and I know that a lot of people, but particularly parents concerned about this, will find all kinds of things to value in the Emily Post, The Gift of Good Manners, A Parent's Guide to Raising Respectful, Kind, Considerate Children. It's published by Harper Resource, and one of the co-authors, Cindy Post-Senning. Cindy Posenning, a real pleasure to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you.
Well, thank you very much. It was my pleasure also.
And the time is 8:56 here on WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, something different from what was initially announced. On tomorrow's Morning Show, I look forward to welcoming into the studios two of my faculty colleagues from Carthage College, Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, who conducts the Carthage Choir, and Dr. Peter Dene, who directs the Women's Ensemble. Each of their groups are just back from splendid tours. The Carthage Choir, just back from their first ever tour of Spain, and the Women's Ensemble, back from their first ever tour of China. And you can imagine what kind of exciting stories they have to share about those very rich adventures. So that's what we're actually going to do on tomorrow's Morning Show in anticipation of the homecoming concerts, which each group will sing. The Carthage Choir on Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, the Women's Ensemble Sunday afternoon at 1:30. Both concerts at Siebert Chapel on the campus of Carthage, both concerts free and open to the public. So we'll have those retrospectives, travel retrospectives on tomorrow's program with both directors and a handful of students reminiscing about their trips. And on Friday, somewhat in the same vein, we're going to be turning our focus to a nation which has been very much in the news as of late, Cuba. I'll be speaking with Professors Jeffrey Roberg and Penny Seymour back from a recent trip to Cuba, not with any students in tow. This was a study trip of their own. And they will come back and share with us their impressions of Cuba and what Cubans are having to say about some of the recent developments involving relations between the United States and Cuba. So that's going to be on Friday's Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The Morning Show archive can be found on our website, WGTD.org. Click on Talk. Our weather forecast is for partly cloudy skies today and quite cold, a high of just 19 degrees. Bitterly cold tonight. Our low drops to 4 below and wind chills to 26 below zero overnight. Tomorrow should be sunny, but still very, very cold. Tomorrow's high just 13 degrees and wind chills easily 20 below zero tomorrow. Our temperatures, however, will begin to moderate tomorrow night. By Friday, under cloudy skies, we should have a high of a balmy 30 degrees, even a little warmer than that on Saturday. Although we could have kind of a mess on our hands Saturday night into Sunday with a mix of snow and freezing rain. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake